Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
You know, there used to be only two ways to meet for business, over the phone or in person. Now there's a better way. Use GoToMeeting to meet online. With GoToMeeting, everyone sees your computer desktop on their computer screen. So you get the best of both worlds. It's like meeting in person, but without wasting time and money traveling. And your conference calls will be more effective. The best part is that you can actually try it for free. That's right, GoToMeeting is free right now for 30 days. For this special offer, you must visit www.gotomeeting.com/podcasts. That's gotomeeting.com/podcasts for a free trial. Hello, how are you? Welcome. Andrew Horowitz here from the Disciplined Investor Podcast, episode number 122. We are in the ending of the summer down here in Florida. Kids start school like the 25th or the 20th of August. It is absolutely awful. We've actually fought the school board on this, but they say that it's a big help because of electricity, hurricane season, and the like. And I don't really understand, because if it's hotter, listen, if it's hotter in the summertime in Florida, why are we putting kids back to school earlier? And how does that help electricity? I really don't understand. Then they say, well, it's really not that. It's that they coordinate with the colleges, because colleges in Florida start a little bit early. They have a requirement, some of those colleges, for a summer schedule. One of my daughters, actually both of my daughters, they go to different schools. They went to summer school this year to get their required summer graduation or educational credits. That was kind of interesting. Spent some time over at Gulf Coast and over at FSU, and wow, what great schools we have down here in Florida. Education probably better in other places, you could say, on the pre-college or the elementary and the regular education. But nonetheless, the colleges are pretty neat. So I thought that we would talk about a few things today. You know that I love the summer. I got to tell you, I've talked about it many times. It's just so hot out here. I'll tell you, I told you last week, I'm going to give a little more of a secret. I told you last week that I love reading the Investor's Business Daily on a Saturday. But there's nothing better than picking up the Investor's Business Daily on the weekend and maybe even some of the other magazines that I like, The Economist, Bloomberg Markets. Things that you don't kind of read every single day, and it kind of goes a little bit different than the regular basic things that are read. I like Barron's, again, weekly kind of commentary. And on a hot summer day, like a meatloaf, it's like a meatloaf song, but on a hot summer day, sitting out back, kind of in the, 11, 12, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock time period by the pool, and just baking. Now, it's not good. I put on plenty of sunscreen, but there's nothing like kind of getting so hot and just diving in the pool and getting back out and reading. I don't know about you, but I'm going to have a couple more months, I guess maybe one more month of this through September, but then it's all over and starts getting a little bit chilly, not as cold, but chillier in Florida. So what I thought we'd do today is we have a great guest, Mish Shedlock. Many of you love listening to him about his economics, his predictions. You know, he was the one that it was the summer of 08, predicted let me think about this for a second. It was actually, I guess it was September of 08, predicted another 40% down. And that was the topic of our podcast that day. And by golly, that's exactly what happened. So I'm sure you want to hear what his predictions are now on the economics and the markets around the world. We'll talk about that in a minute. What I thought I'd also do is provide you with something special today. We talk a little bit about quantitative analysis, the quant methodology, screening. I've talked about this a lot in my book, The Disciplined Investor, by the way, available on Kindle, available on Audible, available at Amazon, and of course the book itself, $13. It's like, I don't know, at iTunes it's like $8 or $9 for the Audible version. Chapter 2 talks about something that we call quantitative analysis. And I thought we'd talk about that because that's something that we use quite often as a matter of fact, it is the starting point of what we do to find stocks. Don't you find it sometimes difficult to find a stock? Yeah, sure, you know about what you wear, whether it's Abercrombie or whether you shop at Walmart, or you know about what you eat, whether it's Campbell's soup or you know Taco Bell, and you know about you know technology, Apple, IBM, Microsoft, etc. But you know what about those things that you don't know so much about? You know, you're not driving a B-22 bomber, or you're not driving an F-14. You don't know about maybe Lockheed and Boeing, and maybe those are good stocks to own. Maybe you don't know about the infrared systems that are being used to find swine flu in airports. Well, maybe FLIR systems is a stock that you want to look at. But, you know, how do you get to these? How do you find the quality stocks out there, or how do you find the stocks that you want to research further? Well, we use screens. And I'm going to read you something really quickly from chapter 2 of my book. Because what happens oftentimes, I find, with investors is we use emotions. And here's what I said. I said, emotions play an important role in our everyday lives. People's instincts usually alert them to, you know, avoid certain food situations and sometimes other people that they believe may be harmful. Surely you've had those gut feelings that seem as real as the air you breathe. There are even people who rely on their intuition to make many important decisions. Maybe that's you. I don't know. But have you ever been investing in a stock and you said to yourself, it just doesn't feel right, or I really think this is going to be a winner? That enthusiasm or fear is an emotional response to information that we as humans are processing. The reaction is filtered through a host of preconceptions and learned behaviors that have built up through our lifetimes. And then I get into a discussion and into some classical conditioning discussions there, and then we get into some exact screens and how to do it. You can go to Money Central, FinViz, and a few other places, and you can actually go place by place. In particular, I put all the how-tos, how to find, how to do a screen, how to look at growth at a reasonable price, some peg ratios, momentums and earnings up, sappy slugs. They're all in this chapter, and they talk about that. But I thought I would do today, if you get a chance to do that, I recommend you get that, because if you haven't used quantitative screens, it's a great starting point. But I thought what we'd do today is I would give you a screen that we ran especially for this show. It's similar to one of the screens we use for our investing. I changed it a little bit to kind of enhance it a little bit, make it a little bit easier to understand, easier to do. And I thought what I'd do is share with you the methodology, and then teach you how to do it. I also give you the results. But really what I want to do here is give you a learning experience, because what we do in the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy, which is how we manage money for our clients, either that or our global asset allocation strategies, we use these as starting points. That's how we find the stocks that we're investing in. Then we go through the next stage, which is a fundamental analysis. Then we go through the next stage, which is a technical analysis. So it's a three-part process, the Quanta Funda Techna process. And if you want to find out more about that, on the show notes is a link to actually a 14-minute virtual tour of the strategy if you're interested in investing with us, $50,000 minimum. But here's what I want to do. Let's go through the exact parameters of this particular screen that I built for this episode. And then we'll get to Mish. And then I'm going to read a couple of emails that I got in that I thought were interesting from some listeners. So let's take a look at this screen. So what I wanted to do is I'm going to step you through the... Hang on a second. Let me grab this. Okay, I got the screen. All right, so this is what we did. We ran, and you can do this at a lot of places. We use Bloomberg systems, and those we prefer very clean data and trusted data, because you know if one of these data points is wrong, you're in bad shape. But nonetheless, like FinViz, or I mentioned that before, FINViz.com, or Microsoft Money Central has a great screener. I recommend that very highly. We got about 14 positions out of this particular screen. Let me tell you what we did. We start out with the universe of U.S. only stocks. Okay, so here's how a screen works. You input criteria. You say, okay, I want to look at U.S. stocks. Okay, so out of the 50 or 100,000 stocks that may be available, let's say in the worldwide stock database that you may be looking at, maybe only 5,000 are U.S. based or something of that nature. So first of all, we put that in, and what happens? It initially gives us a cut point, right? It gives us the actual number of securities that will meet that criteria. From there, what I did was we put in a market cap. The size of the company was limited. So we said we want at least $1 billion. This is going to be the larger of the companies, right? The large companies out there. And then we wanted to have what we would say is the basic, listen to this, this is important. We're talking about EPS here. The last quarter's basic EPS on a five-year basis, okay? The last quarter's basic EPS on a five-year average basis. So we look at the last quarter, and we look at 5 years back, and we look at the average EPS growth of that is greater than 20. We want to make sure that the five-year average growth of the earnings per share are greater than 20% per year. So far, we're looking at growth stocks here, right? Stocks that have kept a great growth reputation over the years. Then we're going to look at the period-over-period growth of the fiscal year earnings per share on a one-year basis. We want to see that the last year's earnings were greater than the five-year average. So now we looked at the quarterly and 5 years back. Now we're looking at the annual, and we're going to look 5 years back to make sure that we're consistently higher. Quarterlies are higher on average, and the latest one is higher, and the annual is higher than the long-term average. Again, so what we're really looking at here, not to confuse you with this, but we're looking for companies that have strong growth potential, that have been able to, year in and year out, give investors an excellent growth opportunity for their underlying the underlying earnings for the stock. Okay, then we want to find the latest fiscal pre-tax margin. I want to have greater than the five-year average. In other words, we want margins increasing. All this is trend issues. We want to see that the earnings are increasing. We want to see that the earnings on a short-term basis are increasing, longer-term basis are increasing, and then we want to have the margins increasing, which then drops down the earnings and the net earnings to the bottom line. Right? Make sense? Okay. Then we want to have the pre-tax margin. We talked about this for a moment before. We want to have the pre-tax margin being, let's say, growing. And then, again, we want to have the five-year average and looking back at the latest being also larger. Okay? We want to have the average volume at least 250,000 shares at least. And we want to have the latest fiscal return on equity greater than 15. Now, the more criteria that we add, the more it refines the output, right? So if you were to say, for example, just let's make it easy, U.S. stocks that have the largest one U.S. stock that is available out there, well, that would give you one stock. We could say, well, give me the top 10 largest as an example, a real easy example of the large capitalized stocks in the U.S. market. Well, that would give us 10. What we did here, we didn't limit it by number of stocks. We just said we want the market cap to be over $1 billion. We want the EPS on a the latest EPS to be greater than the five-year average EPS, earnings per share. We want the growth of the EPS latest to also again, and the 1 year to be greater than the five-year average. We want the pre-tax margin to be growing, et cetera, et cetera. And then we want to have stocks that actually had some volume. So what came out of this? Well, we have a mixed bag. We have companies like Medco Health Solutions, MHS, which we recently sold at the top, actually. Beautiful gain on that. These can be, of course, there's more research that has to go into this, but a great stock that deals with medical efficiency, we'll call it, and the technology behind it. Express Scripts, another healthcare stock, if you will. And Express Scripts is all about the efficiency, again, of prescription drugs, et cetera. Campbell Soup, boring you may think, but boy, they've been putting it out year in and year out. And in this kind of environment, Campbell Soup probably is one of our biggest winners that we had since we bought it some time ago. We have Peabody Energy and Consol Energy. These are both, we'll call it coal-based and natural, energy-efficient, cleaner burning. Consol we've invested in. Actually, we sold it recently for a beautiful gain. It kind of clicked up a little bit higher recently, and then it's been coming down a little bit. Cerner is another one of the healthcare, kind of a trend here in the healthcare. We have healthcare. We have FLIR Systems, something that we own right now. I mentioned that before. Infrared cameras, and not only for the military, but also for things like if you're in an airport and you're coming through the customs or coming through the gateway, what happens is they can kind of shine this on you, a camera in infrared, and see if you have a fever and then kind of pick people out that may be in a fever situation and have the flu or the swine flu. Walter Energy is an energy company. Green Mountain Coffee, I got to tell you, it makes our list all the time. It kind of moves up a lot, and I keep scratching my head. How is that going to last? I've said before that it seems to me that's the next Crocs. That drops down just, you know, like from the sky. Sohu, we have a Chinese internet portal slash gaming slash basically an internet-based technology company. World Food Services, interesting. Actually, one of the top on the IBD list. They make fuel additives. Olin and Hexel. So this 14, we're going to put this actually, go to the website, go to the show notes. It says on the top there, show notes on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and we'll put the results of the TDI core screen, we'll call it, for this episode, and take a look at that. What I want you to do is really practice with this concept. We're not going to take it too much longer than this, but practice with this concept and try to do some screens and then do research after that, okay? That's we find the best way to find opportunities. to make profits, or in fact, to save things. You know what? If you have a screen that you like really a lot, and you have a stock that's on it, and you keep running it, and then 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, a year later, all of a sudden, one of the stocks isn't on there anymore, I could say, hey, maybe that's a sell point. Maybe that's something I need to be aware of. So screens can be used also for a buy standpoint, maybe some shorts. You know, you could do a screen that shows for shorts. Look at maybe EPS slowing. Look at pre-tax margin slowing. Look at average daily volume maybe increasing if the shares are down. I mean, these are all different things you could do. Fundamentals and technicals could all be screened on in the right screener. So anyway, I thought that would be interesting. When we get back, we're going to talk to Ms. Shedlick. Again, go to the website. You can grab this. I put the link on the website of grabbing the results of this screen. Do not invest in these without researching them more, please. It's just an idea generator for you. And then also, I thought that I'd read some couple of emails that I thought were interesting. We'll wrap it up. All right, from now, let's take it out with some summertime cha-cha music. We get to Ms. Shedlock. You're listening to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Stick around. Be right back. All right, and one of our favorite guests of all time is Mike Ms. Shedlock and from Sitka Pacific. I'll give you some information on the blog notes to find where he's at. But, you know, he brings to us some great information, been on the show many times, good friend of mine, and thought we'd talk some economics and also a study that he recently wrote on post-crash dynamics of equity markets. Hello, Mike. How are you? Mish, how are you?
It's Andrew. It's a pleasure to be back on the show.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the economics that we've been seeing lately. It's been a mixed bag. We saw some of those wonderful green shoots in the area of, I don't know, we saw some retail a few months ago that looked better. We're seeing some things are less worse. That's the big thing today, the less worse, of course, the second derivative type of concept. And then this week, we saw a mixed bag. We saw some employment numbers that weren't as good. Retail sales looked abysmal. But in the face of that, retail stocks, and particularly in the clothing stocks, went up. Maybe that was because of the Walmart earnings. But what's your take on kind of what's going on just on the economic side of things?
Well, let's talk about the earnings here first with Walmart. Walmart's actually cutting costs. They beat lowered estimates. But the interesting thing is the way they beat it. They beat it by inventory management. Yep. How sustainable is that, Andrew? I don't think it is. But the story today is actually pretty interesting. The Walmart is cutting prices. Safeway is cutting prices. There are the Canadian equivalents. I don't remember the store names off the top of my head, but they are cutting prices in Canada. So we have a huge dynamic here. The only reason why retail sales have been up at all, it has to do with autos, the cash for clunkers.
Yep.
And in spite of that, in spite of cash for clunkers, if ever there was a time for retail sales to go up, and the expectation today was for retail sales
absolutely.
To go up,
right?
And the expectation was missed. So here's some numbers that I got from Dave Rosenberg. Furniture sales slid 0.9%. Flat or down each of the last 5 months. Ditto for building materials, which collapsed 2.1%. General merchandise dropped 0.8% in July. Sporting goods plunged 1.9% in July, the second such decline in the past 3 months. Web-based sales are down. Retail control down. Consumer spending in general fell 2.2%.
But let me say one thing. Let me just interrupt you for a minute. What's interesting about if you looked at the actual raw numbers of the report on the retail, what you found, one thing that just stuck out in my head was that the gasoline sales year over year, gasoline stations, down 32% year over year. That's an astonishing number.
That is an astonishing number. And it's going to continue to, you know, to post numbers like that. Remember, though, you know, we're comparing gasoline prices now at what do you have? I've got something like $2.50, $2.80 a gallon, or something like that.
$2.75.
Prices were over $4 a gallon a year ago.
Right.
The price of crude is roughly around $70 now. It was $140.
Right.
In July and August a year ago when prices started crashing. So on a year-over-year basis, we've got some easy comparisons. However, but You know, we've seen crude prices rally from 35 to 70, but they've roughly been going sideways here around the 60 to 70 for a number of months. So I suspect that once these green shoots wither on the vine, which I think they're going to do, gasoline prices and prices of copper, prices of raw materials, are actually going to head back down again. So on a relative basis, we're going to have some easy comparisons because of the sharp rebound going ahead. So I'm looking at this. I'm expecting the CPI to continue falling. We, you know, we'll watch that in the latest CPI numbers. But with all this cost-cutting that's going on now at Walmart, at Safeway, and Safeway lowered on, or Walmart lowered baked beans, Black Angus beef, flat panel TVs, and Safeway cut 25% up prices up to 25% on staples like coffee, paper products, laundry supplies, the stuff that, you know, people are always going to continue to use.
So what is that? Is that for sale purposes, or is that because they need to be competitive? But let me, there's something that's really been troubling me lately. Tell me if you can, you're the economy guy. Let me ask you this. Deflation is usually bad. A deflationary market, because you have to cut costs, like you just told me about Walmart and Safeway, and people are earning less. So that's what's all happening, this spiral down of pricing, and therefore earnings are going to collapse and get worse. Okay, fine. Put that in one side. Inflation is bad because your earning power of your money doesn't go as well. But yet at the same time, let me turn this around now. Each time that we hear that the deflationary environment, particularly in Japan, it keeps on getting worse and worse, the stock market rallies because they believe that the economic policy of their equivalent of the Federal Reserve will stay very accommodative. So therefore, they're all excited about that in the stock market, right? But on an economy standpoint, you have to think about this and wonder, is that really good? On the other hand, inflation could be considered good because then all of a sudden we're saying, hey, look, things are being bought. There's an inflationary environment. There's more demand. That's the causation of price increase. So in a sense, investors right now are taking deflationary economic environment variables as a positive, and they're taking potentially inflationary environment variables as a positive. Which one is really true?
Well, I think I don't know. It's hard to say what the stock market's going to do or how it's reading things. There's a number of factors. We'll talk about corporate bonds and the relationship to the stock market in just a moment. But from my perspective, deflation is a good thing. From the point of view of the average consumer, he's happy to see prices go down, especially a consumer that's out of a job. I think to compete globally, prices and wages need to both fall, and that's what's happening here now. Consumers have overspent over the last 8-10 years. They're way deep in debt. They need to start paying off some of that debt, and lower prices are going to help them, providing, of course, they have a job, which is the other side of the equation. But all of these stimulus things are just a short-term one-off thing.
But wait. You can go on. I need to interrupt you, and I'm not trying to be rude, but I'm so excited about what you're telling me here. I don't understand something, though. Prices going down leads to lower earnings, lower profits, potentially, right? Unless you sell a lot more, but let's say that's not the case. They're dropping the prices. Dropping the prices, earnings less. Therefore, you need to lay off more people. Laying off more people needs to come around. They have less money to spend. Less money to spend means that you have to drop prices more so that people can afford it, which means that you're going to have to lay off more people. Where does this spiral end?
The spiral ends when prices get low enough that people can afford to buy things. That's the problem with trying to prop up the price of houses, trying to prop up the price of cars, trying to prop up the prices of things. It's a mistake that Roosevelt made in the Great Depression. He actually went out trying to prop up the prices of food and actually burned crops, depriving people of their livelihood. It prolonged the Great Depression by a lot. It made things worse. It took away people's only source of living, you know, destroying the crops. Mm-hmm. He took away their wages, and he took away the food. And it just made no sense. We're playing essentially the same game right now, as Carolyn Baum pointed out, in cash for clunkers. We're offering people $4,500 for a car or a truck that's maybe worth $500, but those are still productive trucks. Perhaps it's not even fully depreciated, some of them that they're offering, and we're giving $4,500 to someone who trades that thing in and buys a new car. Well, we're destroying productive assets, much the same as Roosevelt burnt crops, and destroying productive assets never makes any sense. What it's going to do is drive up the price of parts. It's going to affect the used car market. All kinds of repercussions at taxpayer expense, I might add you, because we're giving these people money, a selective group of people that all happen to have one thing in common, which is they own a clunker.
You know what, so, Mish, what's interesting about the clunkers, tell me if I'm right about this. First of all, just so everybody understands something, when Mish says that they destroy a working asset, once the car is considered a clunker, it's sold, the contract is done, everything on the new car is done, the clunker then goes to a junkyard. The junkyard is required to pour sodium silicate or some other strange corrosive and seizing mixture into the gas and mix it in, and it will actually seize up and seal and totally destroy the engine, okay? And the engine is no longer any use. Now, the rest of the car can be then disassembled and used and sold off for parts, etc. So that's interesting, number one. Number two, what I find most interesting about this is the people that have the clunkers that couldn't buy the cars before, are we front-loading the car sales that are going to be stolen from the future? And more importantly, these people that had these clunkers that really maybe, possibly, a lot of them couldn't afford a car and that's why they had the clunker, maybe. Now all of a sudden they're walking in and they're getting, do you know, I've looked in the newspaper, 72-month loans. 72 months. I never saw that before. 72. Trade in your cash for clunker, get $4,500, put no money down, $175 a month for a Toyota Camry or whatever it is, 72-month deal. So now this is all of a sudden extending out these loans. And we have people that are getting loans and having to pay for things. So in a sense, that's the second thing. The third thing is, you know, you remember you have an 800 number. Nobody really cares anymore about an 800 number because there really aren't those toll calls like there used to be for the most part. But, you know, you call an 800 number and you wonder, it's a free call. It's a free call. Well, somebody has to pay for it, for goodness sakes. Cash for Clunkers is not a free call. It's not an 800 number. That $4,500 has to come out of somewhere, which we can go on for hours talking about. Where is that money coming from?
Well, the money's coming from the U.S. taxpayer. It's coming from the government creates selective winners. They created a selective winner in the GM settlement, stiffing the bondholders for the benefit of GM union workers. That was decidedly unfair. Cash for Clunkers is decidedly unfair, and Robert Toll of Toll Brothers is out saying yesterday that cash for clunkers for houses is a no-brainer.
Oh,
so Toll wants to destroy productive houses for whose benefit? Certainly, you know, not the average U.S. taxpayer, but for the benefit of Robert Toll. All these programs have one thing in common. The people that are standing up cheering these programs, it was the auto dealers, of course, cheering the cash for clunkers, and now Toll Brothers and the National Association of Realtors is cheering the same thing over there. All these little bailouts go to selective groups of people, all at a long-term cost, because the nation is going into debt for the benefit of a select group of people, and all we do in the process is take away demand from next year, just as you said. So auto sales were up. They're probably going to be up for the next few months on cash for clunkers. Got it right, finally.
Mm-hmm.
But the sales are going to drop back next year. So, you know, where is the long-term benefit from this? There isn't any.
All right, so let's talk about, you know, what the effect is now, and let's talk about how you and I have talked about the bond market, the corporate bond market, which amazingly, and particularly in junk bonds, risk came back almost as fast as it evaporated. Did you notice that? I mean, we're talking about evaporation of risk over a few-month period. Everybody wanted out of the market. Nobody wanted anything to do with it. Although still a lot of people I talk to, I must tell you, are still very scared of this market. And don't want anything to do with it. I don't know if you've noticed that. They just don't, you know, like, I don't need to be involved with this. I don't really care how high it goes. Let's see where this thing kind of levels off and gets a little bit out of the insanity zone. But that's what they say.
Well, more than likely, those that are ignoring it are those that probably got cashed out right at the bottom somewhere. And those people are probably never going to come back in. You've got another person that's just hanging on, hoping to get back to some sort of level so that they can get out. And the amazing thing there is, the higher the market goes, the more and more they're looking at. In other words, you know, someone who probably said when the S&P was at 666, oh, if this thing just gets back to 900, I'm going to get out.
Right.
Well, the market rose back to 900, and I'm going to hang around more. And I think eventually all these people are going to get sucked into believing that, you know, that the bottom is in forever. The market's going to start dipping at some point. Then they're going to say, "Oh my God, I could have had 1,000 last month. If it gets just get me back to 1,000 again, like I had last month," and then it'll drop to 800. And so, "Oh my God, I could have gotten out at 1,000. I told myself I would have gotten out of at 900, and now we're back at 800. I think this is all going to go in reverse. People are just going to hang on, and they're going to give back all of these gains. But in the meantime, I pointed out on my blog a little bit earlier today something about the corporate bond market. The corporate bonds were up 23 consecutive days ending yesterday, and today, at the time I did the post, they were only down one basis point. In other words, they were flat. And I've got a chart of the S&P during this 23-day corporate bond rally. It was up or flat on every one of those days, sometimes big. The red candles were really tiny and thin, doji kind of candle.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The white candles were huge, big. 23 consecutive days of rally in corporate bonds, with the stock market going up from roughly 872, to here we are today. Where did we close?
Somewhere 10:13. Around, exactly. 10:15 or something like that. So what is that telling you? I mean, what is the point here, and what do we have to pay attention to the corporate bond market for?
As long as corporate bonds have a bid, the stock market's probably going to have a bid as well. So, you know, the question here is, how long does the corporate bond market get a bid? I don't know the answer to that, but it's firm. Companies are raising cash, and they're raising cash at lower and lower rates with every rally. What that means is they're stashing away money. They're protecting themselves against the next downturn so that they have enough cash to survive. And just compare, for instance, General Motors versus Ford. Ford survived without going through bankruptcy because it raised more cash relative to operating costs than did GM. It had enough, at least for the time. I think the day of reckoning is going to come for Ford. But it survived for now, while GM didn't, because it had access to the corporate bond market. We're seeing the same thing now. In effect, what we're seeing is zombie corporations, companies that should not survive, do survive just because they have access to the credit markets. GM survived for how many years with all of those operating losses? Only because it had access to the corporate bond market.
Okay, so now, Mish, why is that? Let's suppose that I'm Mr. Smart Investor, okay? And I'm walking down the street looking for good opportunities, and I look at, oh, there's a bond that's being offered for, let's say, 6%, much higher than the current rate I can get on most places, CDs, and, you know, most government paper, of course, and even municipals. Okay, great. 6%. But, you know, what do I do? I just throw my money in, not caring? Why would I do such a thing?
Well, I don't know why you would. I certainly wouldn't recommend it. I'm just we were just talking about what people did. People even bought, there was a name for those GM bonds. Do you remember, by the way? They had some sort of Invest for America. You know, I forget the name
right.
of
yeah,
them.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Where they really sucked in a lot of retail buyers. And those guys were screwed. They lost almost everything.
But what is with this ravenous? First of all, where's the money coming from? And what is with this ravenous desire? Is it being an arbitrage deal? I mean, you could basically maybe many of the banks are buying this stuff up at 6% and getting money from the Fed at 0 to 25 basis points. I mean, where is this?
I don't think it's coming from the Fed. I think because, and the reason why I say that is if you look at the excess reserves on banks, they're all sitting in U.S. Treasuries with the Fed. So the banks are very reluctant to lend here. So this is just coming from the corporate bond market. People that are sitting on cash and just everyone in general believing the worst is over, and so we're getting this rally here. There's a massive belief that the bottom is in. And I'm not sure what it takes to shatter that belief. And you know, quite honestly, and I've talked about this, it could be that the bottom is in. However, if the bottom is in, then I think the best we're going to do is go sideways to slightly down for the next 5 years. The Hussman had a very interesting post the other day called Post-Crash Dynamics. And he showed a chart of various markets, the Dow Jones Industrials from 1929 to 44, gold from 1980 to 1996, the Nikkei from 1990 to 2006, and the S&P is just started now from 2007 to 2009. And I drew some lines on his chart, and one thing we noticed that these big crashes last about 20 or 30 months. And then there's a period of up to 12 years where the market goes absolutely nowhere. I've talked about many times on my blog two lost decades in Japan. The Nikkei was at 38, almost 40,000 in 1990. Today it's at 10,000, but it fell down to from 40,000 all the way down to 15,000 in 1992. That was what the 3 year period there, where we said roughly from 20 to 30 years we have a crash, and the market just meandered around for the next, literally going on two decades now. It's even slower today at 1,000 than it was, you know, after the crash 3 years later. And if we look at the a chart of the NAS crash, we see the same thing. We saw the QQQ rose to 101 in 2000. It fell all the way down to 20 in 2003. Then over the course of the next year, it got almost but not quite up to 40, almost doubling. Well, it was at 19, and it did rise to 38. It did double. And then it went sideways, and here we are 5 years later now at 40. So that's the dynamics here of what happens after the crash. And now we've seen in the S&P, what have we seen? We've seen it fall from over 1,400 all the way down to 666. We've now rallied to 1,000. What now? If we follow the Japan pattern, we're just going to slowly give this back up over the next decade. That's what I think happens. Or if we follow the NAS crash kind of environment, we're just going to meander around here sideways for the next 5 years, then maybe dip, and then maybe, you know, break even 5 years from now. I think, realistically, that's the best we can expect out of these markets. That's the lesson in these crash dynamics.
So we're not going back up to the top on the S&P anytime soon? I mean, really, at 1% a day, we could be there in another, what, another 2 months?
Well, I suppose we could. How realistic is that? We've already seen a close to a 50% rally in 49 days. This is the biggest rally since 1932? But there was a 130% rally in there, and then all of that was given back when we went back and tested those lows. Could the same thing happen here? I suppose this rally can go on, and I'm certainly looking at some of them QQQ rally on the NASDAQ, that lasted for a year, a little bit more than a year, actually. So I suppose the S&P could keep rallying for a year. We're only a few months into this
thing,
actually.
The only difference I see between this and a lot of comparisons made to the Great Depression, all that, the difference I see here is that, okay, cost-cutting is one thing, fine, but the use of technology is a double-edged sword, you know. And I wrote a paper recently, and we call this consumption cannibalism. Basically, where you lay off people, and that's why the productivity is up so dramatically. Even though you don't have anything going on, you have a lot less people putting on a lot more because technology is assisting them. Alcoa came out with an announcement on their earnings that 75% of their total workforce had been laid off, and if in fact they resumed with some level of demand and it got even peaked out, they would not be replacing employees. That's,
right.
You know, that's an amazing, amazing commentary. I mean, shocking commentary. But what happens there is the problem, and I've mentioned this before, is that machines, different than humans, don't eat, sleep, poop. They don't buy shirts. They don't consume. They don't do anything.
And think about it. Even at grocery stores, they're putting in these self checkout lanes. You know, again, costing jobs. Now, I have a feeling that might backfire. The odds of theft and fraud on those self checkout lanes is pretty high. I mean, you know, pull two packages of meat, stick them together, scan one of them through, one on top of each other, and all of a sudden the you know, stores lost, you know, $15, perhaps their whole profit and then some.
Is that your technique?
On a whole cartload of groceries.
Is that your technique?
No, I've just merely thought about it. I hate those lanes. I never use them.
Yeah.
Those damn machines don't work for
me.
But I'm merely pointing it out, and it goes on with what you were saying. Some people like those machines. Maybe those are the ones that are scanning because of the meat through. But the question is, I mean, we do have this rising productivity, and supposedly that's supposed to filter through on wages, but it sure isn't, is it?
Nope.
And
wages were up a little bit. Wages were up, and work week was up a little bit last period, but yes, not
0.1,
dramatically.
I saw that. The how much of that was due to cash for clunkers and a rebound in demand for autos? That's what I'm trying to figure out.
Well, one of the things that's also interesting is that very well timed, the cash for clunkers at the end of July is very, you know, right about this quarter is very nice, because what's going to happen is that's going to be an instant jump in the GDP numbers, right?
Yes.
So can you explain something to me, and then we'll close on this maybe. Does GDP positive and out of recession mean out of the woods and that everything is hunky-dory?
Oh, no. I mean, we're rebounding from a pretty significant depth here. And one has to put that in perspective. The amount it's lost, I mean, if you gain the same thing back, you're not back up to even. And the same thing, I mean, just look at the stock market. If you fall 50%, it takes 100% rally just to get back to even. So, you know, the numbers aren't quite so bad when you're dealing with the low numbers there on the GDP. But, you know, we can see, you know, some small improvement. And look at auto sales. We're going to see a big improvement in auto sales. But remember, they're coming from depressed levels. If auto sales level off here, which I think is likely after this cash for clunkers rebound here, we went from what was 9.5, you know, in sales up to 11. But remember, we were at 16 a couple of years ago. So the new norm now might be 11 million. And that's all we get. And so we've still got rampant overcapacity. In spite of GM going bankrupt, what closed? There aren't any plants. GM didn't go out of business. It's still operating. Ford's still operating. I don't know whether GM sold Hummer or not, but there's been no capacity reduction anywhere that I've seen. And in China right now, They have been importing commodities like mad, ramping up growth for what consumers? The consumers in China haven't picked up the slack. So we've got an increase now because of what China's doing and the productive capacity in China. So none of this helps. We need a washout. I think the washout is coming. I think China is going to overheat. Man, we can talk about China. Maybe we should do that next time for quite some time, because mm-hmm. all of these things are lining up. They're trying to stimulate the consumer, but the numbers show today the consumer wasn't stimulated.
Right. And the other thing about China that's interesting is, you know, you wonder over the last week or so. I mean, that market came down about 12% in the Hong Kong side. Hong Kong was down 5 or so on the China side. But basically, what's interesting there is there's a big concern. There's going to be some regulatory environment on the stock market. But also, we're seeing that exports are pathetic. You know, the only stimulus, the only thing that's happened is internal. Right. And I really question one big thing, that if in fact we're in an inventory. If we're in an inventory refresh, okay, which, by the way, mm-hmm. the numbers this week did not show that.
I know they didn't. Okay. Everyone was expecting it,
right.
too.
Right, but if we were in an inventory refresh, which would be kind of interesting because that would play to what you were saying. If you have an inventory refresh, but the consumers weren't there, companies would be restocking and paying and having expense for those various restock and inventory restocks, and then all of a sudden they wouldn't have the sales, higher expenses, lower sales means EPS goes down, and they probably couldn't offset that. Companies are not yet going after building inventory because obviously they don't see the demand. Obviously, they don't see the demand, because if they did, they'd have to restock. So that's an interesting thing. The second thing is that there is a lot of talk about China really slowing down their purchases of commodities right now. They've kind of restocked up. And finally, what I am having a really tough time understanding is the seemingly good bid to cover ratios on the Treasury auctions. We mm-hmm. do know that the Fed is buying up to 25% of all auctions. Has been Fed buying, by the way. Right. You know, the monetizing, mm-hmm. which one day you'll have to sit down and explain to everybody what that means, because that's pretty sick if you think about it. Okay, you know, basically they're offering the Treasury. It looks like a lot of people are buying.
Well, it's the quantitative easing theory. It's what Japan went through, and ironically, in spite of that quantitative easing, yields rose. I think we're going to see the reverse. That, you know, once the Fed stops trying to manipulate the market and gets out, I think we're going to see a bid come back to Treasuries with the demand. I don't agree with the quantitative easing program. It's just going to exasperate their problems down the road of having to get rid of those Treasuries. It clearly didn't help them at all. So it was a mistake, but they did announce that they're winding down the program, by the end of September?
Yeah, but I don't buy a lot of things they're talking about. They're winding it down, and they said that, and they're going to continue it, and they expanded it, because it would end on its own without any discussion at this meeting before the next meeting, and they need to do something in the meantime, and they need to make it look like, I think what they're doing is they're creating an artificial rush, thinking, you know, mortgage rates may go up, making people run to buy houses. I think that's what they're doing. It's a bluff. I really do.
Oh my God! I don't think people running to buy.
Well, at least they may be thinking
houses,
right.
Yeah.
But let me say one thing. So I don't understand why China keeps on saying they're not going to be buying more treasuries because they're concerned about our financials, but they keep buying them. How does that work?
They have to. This is a function of pure math. People ask me this question all the time. I talked about it in my speech at Google. The question came up there too. It's a function of pure mathematics. If the U.S. is running a trade deficit, someone else, by definition, has to be running a trade surplus.
Right.
What does that mean? That means they're accumulating U.S. dollars. So what do they do with those U.S. dollars? People come back and say, oh, Mish, well, you know, why don't they just buy oil with them? Okay, then what does Saudi Arabia or Iran do with those U.S. dollars? So you get to a situation where, by pure math, if the U.S. is running a deficit, someone else is accumulating those assets, mm-hmm. and if they don't have a place to park them, they park them in U.S. treasuries. So, you know, that's really all that's going on. And, you know, China has another reason for wanting to do that and not doing other things with them is they're inflating their own currency by doing that, weakening it, you know, rather than sterilizing the inputs as they come in and shrinking their own money supply to account for the influx of dollars coming in, China's stimulating their own economy, pumping into it, debasing the renminbi, just in hopes of keeping their export model alive.
Right.
Japan did the same thing. This is the dynamic that's going on, and all these people are out there talking. I think once a day for the last week, someone's emailed me, you know, telling me about this big U.S. dollar debasement that's going to happen. One day we're going to wake up, and the U.S. dollar is going to be lower. They're going to shut the banks, and the U.S. dollar is going to be lower by 50% or something. It's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
The China doesn't want a lower dollar. Japan doesn't want a lower dollar. Europe doesn't want a lower dollar. And besides that, the U.S. dollar floats. There's nothing
right.
to devalue
right.
the U.S.
Right.
dollar against.
Right.
So the whole talk is silly.
Yeah, well, we know a few people that talk about the U.S. dollar going nowhere and buying gold, and I think that's, you know, a little bit for their own benefit, but we could talk about that at another time. I got lots to talk to you about. I have lots of questions. We're going to have to end it right here. Ms. Shedlock, Sitka Pacific Investments. I'll put the link on our site so people can grab that and find out what you talk about and some of the interesting things that you do for business and how you can help people. And as always, I really appreciate your help today.
It's a pleasure being on the show. We'll catch you again next month.
All right, great. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye. Mitch is always great to have. What I thought we'd do is read a couple of emails that we got that I thought were really interesting. One of them came from Warren from Fort Walton Beach, Florida. Thank you, Warren, for listening, and thank you for sending this. But what I thought we'd do is this is interesting because, you know, we talked a few times about how in China they're buying jewelry and wow, it's amazing. They must be, the governments must be just showering money on them. Take a look at a stock, FUQI is the symbol. You need to look at that one. Look at the parabolic rise. They sell China in jewelry in China. But Warren writes, this may be of use to you. I lived in Asia for several years and found their attitude regarding jewelry considerably different from ours. In America, a woman goes to the jewelry store, buys something pretty at a huge markup, and keeps it forever. I have a wife. I know that well. That's my commentary, not his. Not what you would call a good investment. I've tried to convince my wife about that several times, but nonetheless. In Asia, it's different. The family works to save money for a while. Then they go to a jewelry store and buy gold, usually in the form of gold chains or links. Gold is sold at near market value in Asian jewelry stores. Then when things get tight, they take their gold chain back to the jeweler. He takes off a link or two and gives them papered money in return. The jeweler is a de facto bank. As you can imagine, this puts a somewhat different light on the Chinese spending their stimulus checks on jewelry stores at jewelry stores. The government, of course, paints a rosy picture. Things are so good, people are buying jewelry, they say. On the street, though, it's a different word. Things look bad. People are converting their paper money into gold. You can confirm this tradition with some of your Asian counterparts. People buying gold is not a sign of a bright economic outlook. Thank you for your podcast, book, and insight. Hey, Warren, thanks so much. And he mentioned that I'm difficult to email. I don't know why. Just send it off to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. It's kind of pretty easy, I thought. Anyway, I thought that was interesting, and I thought that, you know, generally speaking, that, you know, that does shed a different light on things. And thank you so much for bringing that to us. I'd like, anybody else has some insight into that, I'd like to know if there is something that we're missing here or seeing differently, etc. The next one we have, what do we have from? It's right regarding the Jim Rogers interview. And this is from Jochen in, I think I spelled it, Jochen, from Frankfurt, Germany. And let's see, he says, I listen to your podcast ever since you appeared on the Real Story podcast last January. Your podcast is definitely one of the best in the field. Thank you very much. Also want to thank you for giving Frank Curzio the chance to explain things to many of his listeners last week. Okay, so it's a couple of weeks old, I guess. Now, regarding Jim Rogers, I listen to his rants, but he is repeating himself most of the time and likes to talk his book. For example, Bernanke and Geithner are morons. I'll sell my last dollar soon. Invest in gold. Invest in sugar. Become a farmer. Invest in China. Asia 2009. America 1909. And England 1809. My kids learning Mandarin, etc. You know, while I look forward to listening to him, I, you know, don't know if I can get anything new out of him. One of the things I would like to know is from him, and what he was thinking was, how can he call American politicians' names every time he appears on shows like CNBC? It'd make a country his new home where much milder public criticism of the government would definitely mean immediate removal of his resident permit and probably a defamation lawsuit against him. I can fully understand Mr. Rogers when he puts his economic freedom before his freedom of speech, But in order to stay credible, his position should refrain from criticizing American politicians in such a personal way and praising the economic policies of the Singapore government, let alone China. I've lived in Singapore for 8 years myself. I love the city and probably will want to move back there. I'm also afraid that when the incompetence of Western politicians will prove to be disastrous, but when Roger says about bad Western versus good Asian economics doesn't always add up and makes me wonder if his investment theme does. Best regards. I thought those were just two really interesting emails that I got. Again, if you want to send me anything, ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I'll be happy to check it out and, you know, conversation back and forth and see what we can do to maybe get your question on the air. Also, I want you to mention to you that you need to listen to the DH Unplugged podcast. That's John Dvorak and myself. We do that regularly. Just go to dhunplugged.com or find it on iTunes, even better. Sign up today for that. Check it out. Subscribe. Do me a favor. Let's kind of launch that thing all the way up the rungs, you know, all the way up the iTunes charts. If you just go over there, listen in, I think you'll find it very interesting. It's very entertaining and very interesting. That's all we have today. Basically, go to the website, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, if you want to get a copy of the screen results, the quantitative screen results that we showed you here and that we talked about at the beginning of the show. And, of course, if you want to do the 14-minute virtual tour, go to the site as well. Check it out. I think you'll enjoy it. Find out how we actually invest money for clients utilizing the Quantafunda Techno Strategy for the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy. Until next time. It's going to be the end of August. We'll speak to you soon. This is Andrew Horowitz signing off. Have a great and a successful and a profitable week.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.